Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Athletic.
It didn't take long for the first big flashpoint of Marc Marquez's Ducati career. In just the second weekend of his new life, he collided with reigning world champion stablemate Pecco Bagnaia in the Portuguese Grand Prix. And even if that hadn't happened, between Pedro Acosta getting on the podium, Maverick Vinales winning one race and then making a very strange exit from the other, and Jorge Martin taking what might prove to be a very significant victory, we would have more than enough to talk about on the Race MotoGP podcast this week. I'm Matt Beer, I've got Simon Patterson and Valentin Horinci with me, and we're going to crack straight into all the crazy events of Portimao. And we have to start with the shunt late in the Grand Prix, fighting. It was only fifth place, wasn't it? It wasn't even like it was for the lead or anything. Big Pecco Bagnaia and Marc Marquez come together in what was deemed a racing accident. And they didn't have a huge disagreement over it, but they did definitely have, you know, well, maybe it wasn't a vociferous disagreement, but they had different interpretations of what happened. So, Val, do you want to lead on this one? Take us through exactly what happened, and if you were in the steward's office, would you have gone racing incident? You're kind of fair and diplomatic in most circumstances, so I suspect you might have done.
So I have no idea, so let me try to work out my thoughts on it revisiting it in my head. So Pecco Bagnaia had a pretty bad Sunday race for some reason. Just the pace wasn't there. He said he was particularly struggling through turns four and turns five, which becomes notable here because turn five is the site of the accident. He was struggling for turn-in, as far as I can tell. And if you watch his lines through it at other laps, you can see he goes a little bit wider. When Pedro Acosta was following, Acosta was always hugging the apex very tight through turn five, whereas Bagnaia was sort of doing this. Not necessarily ineffective sweep, but certainly a sweep, and just shedding lap time and eventually being overtaken by Acosta. Not basically like he was standing still, because usually when Bagnaia has at least something to lean back on, you would back him to keep position. But instead it was just a sit and duck. And I think also the Marc Marquez battle was probably only going one way. But it was close to the end of the race. It was the third to last lap, so Marquez gets a good run out of turn four, another corner where Bagnaia is not so good, and just absolutely sends it down the inside of turn five, predictably runs out wide, at which point I don't know how to describe it. I guess he does try to close the door, but also tries to sort of return to a semblance to a racing line, which you can assume that he was going to do something like that. But Bagnaia is still taking his usual line through that corner, which is the slightly wider, far from the apex line. So when they actually collide, because their lines have crossed over, you look at the corner and you see that there's a ton of room between the apex and where Bagnaia and Marquez come together. So it is that traditional sort of overtake of, you know, two guys going for the same spot after an overtaking move disrupted the normal procedure of the corner, but they're really far from the apex, which I think is where Marquez probably comes off blaming Bagnaia. Now, just to recap what they said, yes, the stewards ruled it a racing incident. Both riders more or less agreed with that, but Marquez did sort of hint that he maybe tried to get the stewards to penalize Bagnaia, or at least consider penalizing Bagnaia, because in Marquez's view, Bagnaia was too optimistic. He coded that in strange language that I think wasn't maybe as friendly as you would expect, given that I do think Marc Marquez probably has some designs on being Pecco Bagnaia's teammate next year. Marquez said that it's something Bagnaia, well, he didn't say will learn from, has learned from, like he's learned his lesson. He basically pinned the blame on the decision Bagnaia took in that moment for leaving two Ducati riders with a non-score. He said that basically the battle was lost, and at that point in the race for that position, as opposed to like for a win, as you said, Matt, for fifth place, there was no point in doing that. And yeah, that was basically his logic, more so than it was an illogical move, that it was an illogical move in that race situation, which it never is my favorite argument. I don't think the race situation should come into that too much. I don't think there's such a thing as a, well, if you're fighting for the win, then you're expected to act differently in fighting for fifth. You're fighting for position. You're fighting for every point. Every point might count at the end of the season, especially with how strong Jorge Martin is. So I don't so much like that, but Pecco Bagnaia said he didn't take a risk, and I don't know. I think he did. I think he put up a fight he did not have to put up, whatever position it was for. I think he would have been wiser to let it go there. I don't think I would penalize either, just looking at it over and over and over again. But I think if I went blame apportioning, I'd say 60-40, the 60 being on Bagnaia's side. But it's a tough one. It is a tough collision. And I'm surprised it happened this quickly. It's always going to happen. I'm surprised it happened this quickly.
So we've got a bit of a run recently of you two agreeing on things, and I'm really hoping that this might kind of come to an end now. So Val's gone 60-40, Marquez's fault.
Bagnaia's fault.
Bagnaia's fault. Great. Simon, where do you stand?
I mean, it's not exactly a big disagreement with Val this week, but for me, it's 60-40 Marquez. Straight up, it was a recent incident. Both of these guys had some portion of blame for it because both of them contributed to being in the position where it happened. And someone made the excellent point on Twitter to me that the fact that both of them think the other one is to blame is essentially what makes it a racing incident. Like, that's the almost the definition of it when you know, you've got two guys who are both equally convinced the other was responsible. The thing that just tips it for me in favor of Bagnaia is that I don't think by the point that the contact was about to happen, he was kind of, there was nothing he could have done to avoid it, because his only real path out of it at that point was basically turning tighter, which would probably have tucked the front and taken both of them out. And then it would have been his fault. But by holding his line, he kind of did the, you know, like neutral state thing. Whereas Marquez was the guy who knew that he was there, who could see him quite clearly, and who was closing the line in on him. And Marquez would have had the option to sit up a little bit and let it run away. And I think, let's be honest, the reason that that didn't happen is because if that had it happened, it would have cost Marquez maybe a second, and it wouldn't have cost Bagnaia anything. And at the end of the day, that's, you know, Marquez took the gamble of, if I just hold this line, maybe it won't cause me to crash, maybe it won't cause both of us to crash, and maybe we'll all get away with it, and I'll still be able to try and pass him for the place. I think the most cynical thing that was said by any of them was Marquez's claim that they were only battling for fourth or fifth and it wasn't that important and you didn't need to make moves like that, because I think Marquez said that while making one of those moves.
Yeah.
He was completely complicit 100%. In being in a fight that neither of them really needed to be in. So whether or not that was the case, there's more than enough of that to share. The stewards made the right call. We don't know exactly what's said in the stewarding room, but I'm sure both of them get a bit of a slap on the wrist and told to be a bit more careful in the future, which that's advice that they'll heed for about 20 minutes and then immediately forget and do the exact same thing if they were put in the exact same circumstances tomorrow. And that's okay, because that's motorbike racing and that's what you're supposed to do in those occasions. Racing is racing.
Here's what fascinates me about this crash so much is because I think I wasn't alone in immediately thinking back to last year's Pecco Bagnaia Maverick Viñales Le Mans crash, which was sort of a similar situation of line crossing and who saw who was doing what intentionally. But that was at the start of the race where both of them badly needed to get a move on to win. Basically, that was a situation where either Bagnaia or Viñales, if they stayed on the bike, I think the winner was probably going to be one or the other. Whereas here, they weren't winning nothing. So for me, the context is instead, and the way Marc Marquez raced Bagnaia on the opening lap also supports this for me. These are two guys who think they're racing each other for the championship. For me, that's 100% in play right now.
Pecco Bagnaia wouldn't have done that counter move as aggressively on Pedro Acosta. I think if that had been Acosta in that position, he would have let him go a little bit. He wouldn't have committed to the corner, which is where he could have prevented the accident. Let's be honest, he could have prevented it a little bit by committing to the corner less aggressively and letting him get away with it. I think if it had been positions reversed and he'd been on the one on the outside, he wouldn't have closed in on Marc Marquez the same way. In fact, I don't think he would have closed in on Marc Marquez the same way in any circumstance, because Bagnaia is not that kind of aggressive. I think he's a bit more calculating. and a bit less instinctual. And if he'd been on the outside, he would have taken the time loss from setting it up a little bit and then running at him again later in the lap. Yeah, I think you're completely right, Val. Like, these two guys are two guys who maybe I don't agree with you in that they're immediately fighting for the championship because it's a long year, but they're two guys who are determined that they have to beat each other right now.
That's the key point, I think.
Yeah, Martin's the other guy in that equation at the minute.
Yes.
Those three guys have to beat each other at every occasion now.
But I think it's different with Martin because there's a... Okay, he's leading the championship right now, and in a typical The Race MotoGP podcast event, we'll discuss the race winner and championship leader about 48 minutes into this episode. yeah, Martin's a title threat, a massive title threat, but these two are the ones with the status. You know, Marquez is a six-time champion coming into Ducati. Pecco is a two-time champion who is Ducati darling, re-signed already. There's so much in terms of how the next few years of MotoGP look riding on which of these two guys looks like the king this season. Yeah, and they're probably not expecting Martin to actually overshadow them across the season because they'll be expecting ebbs and flows and peaks and moments of madness from Martin. Again, we'll get onto that later because this was not a mad weekend from Martin at all. But Marquez, like you say, Val, Marquez on Bagnaia on the opening lap was so aggressive. It was such a it felt to me like a bunch of real statement lunges, really kind of, I'm just letting this guy know that I'm here, I'm on his bike now, and I'm going to be racing him like this all season. And he's, and you know, basically just trying to intimidate him. And I felt there were enough moves Marquez made on people during the course of the two races where he would do something similar to what happened in the Bagnaia clash, but carry the speed on the outside and just come back and fight another day a couple of laps later. I think correct me if I'm wrong, because you guys memorize more details than me from these races, but it felt like he was banking the move for later more often, or carrying speed on the outside and attack it at the next corner. Whereas with that one, it's like, I'm coming back onto the apex. You need to get out of my way. This is my corner now. I still think racing incident. And I think that even more strongly because as you guys were giving your takes, my view on whose fault it was changing almost with every sentence. But I think the force with which Marquez wanted to establish himself on Bagnaia this weekend was really, really obvious. And frankly, I love it as a storyline, so no complaints there. I'm a little surprised the clash this early, but you could see something like this was brewing, I felt.
It's adding another alpha dog into the pack, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's essentially what's happened here. Ducati have added another alpha into the pack and they're going to fight to assert dominance.
Which they knew would happen and which will be a consideration.
Of course they did. And which Gigi Delinha is not losing any sleep over.
Yeah. It is the decision they have to make of whether for 2025, because there are two riders who that will be a problem with, and another rider right now who that, as good a weekend as he had, that's not so much of a problem with, but we'll get to him too. The one thing I do want to argue with a little bit, I think, is I don't think it's just intimidation tactics, especially on lap one, because I think Marc Marquez, like we do, also watches these races and probably knew that, look, I have to stop Bagnaia now on the first lap and make his life as hard as possible to minimize the amount of points he's going to score. Because if he's running fourth behind the top three, like right behind them on the opening lap, there's a very good chance that on lap three he's leading by a second and then the race is over. Maybe that wouldn't have happened today, but you can't know that on lap one. So you have to rough him up. You have to make his life as difficult as possible.
It's also worth noting that, you know, there is an aggression on lap one of MotoGP races that just comes naturally as well. I think there was four collisions on the grid on turn one this like today that involved people losing wings and, mm-hmm. and like four collisions involving like 9 or 10 riders. There's just people smashing into each other everywhere these days in the grid. And the further back you go, the worse it gets.
But it's not on TV.
No, exactly. You know, these guys refer to it as the jungle, the middle of the pack to the back. People were getting knocked into all over the place. And sometimes I think we lose focus on that because we only see the guys at the front in great detail at the start of races. But it's just how they are. It's just how all the races are in the first lap throughout the field.
The other interesting thing with this was that Marquez had to be that aggressive on the first laps because he's coming from further back on the grid than he should have been, because he shunted in qualifying for quite an interesting reason that just kind of shows how much he still has to figure out the Ducati. Was it something ride height device related?
Yes, it was. It was the ride height device being activated too early coming through the turn 15 downhill. While he was still on the throttle, but wasn't supposed to be on the throttle at that point, and it just it washed him away immediately. And it's just like the way he described it, his mechanics were asking him, "Why did you push it?" And he was like, "Well, I pushed it." Just a very endearing, just, yeah, you know, I pushed it.
Yeah.
Still learning. And I think he's had three crashes this weekend. The Sunday morning warm-up one was his foot slipped off the foot peg or something. Something of that regard. So he's still, it's really like, it is not push errors so much as it's just untidy mental laps. I still don't know this bike very well errors. It does concern me a little bit. Because that's like three crashes in a weekend. Still, that's a problem. That's Honda numbers. With all due respect.
It's not Marquez Honda numbers, though, is it? That was like 7 or 8.
Well, I guess. I don't know. Marquez led Honda. But you can sort of see how that gets ironed out. But at the same time, you can also see how much he's just immediately clicked himself out of the testing mode, right? Because in testing, again, I think the same thing is happening. Again, in testing, you look at him and you look at the other GB23s, specifically the GB23s, and the levels sort of, they're thereabouts. It's the same. I don't think there was a huge meaningful difference between them, apart from Marco Bezzecchi, who has been struggling. And we've gone into the race weekends now, and he finds that extra gear of just how hard he risks and how much he pushes. And I do sometimes have a little bit of question about his risk-reward approach, maybe especially this season, because I think he is racing for something in terms of the points. But it is still amazing. Like, he made all the other GB23s look bad this weekend, even if it ended in a crash. He's already asserting himself over those guys, and those are good guys. So in that sense, the Portimao weekend for him was a rising success, and I think he's going to dog walk Kota absolutely 100%, but let's see.
Yes.
Oh, he's going to clean up there. Like the body language, the confidence all weekend has been, there's been a bit of swagger. He's been someone that looks really, really pleased with what they're doing. And yeah, like the crashes, crashing is Marc Marquez's MO and has been even in a content stage at Honda when he was winning everything that happened in front of him. It's his way of finding the limit. And some of the crashes, the first crash of the weekend was 100% him finding the limit, to the extent that when I asked him about it on Friday in the press conference or in the debrief, he was like joking and laughing about it. It was like, oh yeah, that's me. That's me doing my thing. Hello, I'm Marc Marquez. the other two are just, I think, a very, very instinctual rider relying on muscle memory that he doesn't have yet.
Yeah.
I think that's all it is. It's just getting those fine details. You know, it sounds silly, but it's little things like, I'm going to use a comparison that might be lost on some people, but Val's going to get it. It's like switching from Xbox to PlayStation.
Yeah, Val's going
to
get it.
There's still game controllers. You know, you're still using a controller, but the buttons are in a slightly different place and they have a slightly different function, and sometimes you push the wrong one. And essentially, when you look at the dashboard of a modern MotoGP bike, they've got as many buttons as a games console controller. And there's an element of just not quite being in the right place with his fingers and not quite, you know, going to reach for something and it not being there and then having to redo it. And it's just that muscle memory process that's going to take a little bit of time, but it's clearly coming.
Oh, and also, like, he had so long at Honda as well, and every new button introduced on the Honda would probably be run past him first to work out where he wanted it. So, yeah, all that instinctive stuff makes complete sense.
Yeah, tough luck. No, you get where Pecco wanted it.
Yeah.
It's a really good comparison, Simon, because like Xbox and PlayStation controllers have sort of moved towards each other over the years, so too do MotoGP bikes basically become the same bike.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's fair.
So, I thought this would happen at some point this season. I thought Marquez on a competitive bike, it's only so long before he has a clash with someone of significance. That's not to be negative about Marquez, but he is a guy who has clashes with people. It's just how his career goes.
It's just how he
it's
is.
Just part, it's part of his thing. I didn't think it'd be round two that he was crashing with Paco Bagnaia. That's like maybe at least two events earlier than I expected. Simon.
The only reason I didn't think it would be round two is because I thought it would take a little bit more time to get to the point where he was running with Pecco Bagnaia.
Yeah.
Realistically, that's the only reason I thought it would take longer. I kind of expected that these first few races, he'd be like battling for sixth and Bagnaia would be battling for the win. And then we'd go to Coda and he'd win it. And then he'd sort of be at the front for the rest of the season. And I think that, you know, Pecco had a bit of a tough weekend. Mark had a good weekend. and those two streams crossed and suddenly they were battling for each other. And oh, look, Pecco's the first guy that has come a cropper on a Ducati with a Ducati rode by Marc Marquez. And it won't be the last time this season because, you know, he attracts trouble. Let's just put it that way.
So what now? It felt with the way they reacted to the crash at Portimao, it didn't feel like this is now war between them or anything else. Marquez's phrasing was quite carefully mischievous, I'd say. I think he'll learn from this, whatever the phrasing was around that. It's like, oh, wow, that's mildly patronising, to say the least. Quite fun. But, you know, I don't feel like Ducati has a problem here yet. But if it happens again quite soon, then this starts becoming a headache, surely. And the points loss is going to become particularly problematic.
Bagnaia's on the back foot a little bit, I think, right now, because we're going to Coda next.
Yeah.
If we were going to Jerez next, or even if we were going to Termas next, he'd have a chance to strike back. He'd have a chance to put a, you know, put a few moves on Mark and show kind of his own status in the team by giving back a little bit. You know, I said earlier that he's quite tactical in his aggression. He thinks about what he's doing. He's capable of riding aggressive. He's capable of giving it out. He's given it out to Jorge Martin on plenty of occasions when it needed to be done. But unfortunately, I don't think anyone's going to see Mark and Coda once the lights go out. So he's not going to really have much of an opportunity to do that next week. But he kind of needs to come out in Jerez, in Le Mans, and just be there and show, you know, kind of make a statement that it hasn't really rattled him. That it's kind of, you know, oh, well, it happened. He was very quick to make the point after the race that he left round two last year with no points as well. And that this isn't this is nothing on the championship because he still won the title last year. So he's been playing that up. Mark has been just as usual, well, not as usual mischievous self, actually, because he's kind of getting back into the swing of it, having not really had the ability to do it too much recently because the form wasn't there all that much. But, you know, he had kind of a broad sweeping media debrief where he was smiling, a smiling man of the people, firing off shots at Pecco, firing off shots at Pedro Acosta, just being Marc Marquez, really. He looks very comfortable at the minute.
I should say, I don't agree with Pecco Bagnaia's interpretation. Although I don't think he like meant it that strongly, but I don't agree with, if he's nonchalant about the points he lost, then I do not agree with that, because Jorge Martin at the start of last year was not the Jorge Martin that he is at the start of this year. There's already a points buffer there. I think Bagnaia is going to be good at Cota. I think, honestly, it is not impossible for me to imagine a situation where he does actually beat Marc Marquez there, but we'll have to see. But they both have to worry about Martin now. He's the third part of this equation. They can't just worry about one another 100%, because Jorge Martin has had a really good weekend at a track that wrecked him in 2021, and that he's now was very, very convincing at this whole weekend, and meaningfully more convincing in the race that pays more points.
And the other thing as well that Pecco can't forget here is he blew the sprint.
He did blow the sprint, yeah.
That should have been a bit of a statement win in a sprint race, and that was his own mistake. And then lack of pace afterwards. Yeah. He didn't really have anything after he'd lost the lead. So it's not been a great weekend for him pace-wise, let alone collision-wise. He's coming away 23 points behind the championship. Now, it's not huge with 5,000 races to go yet, but this was a really wobbly one. And actually, when he made that sprint mistake, I kind of thought, oh, this is why actually it's quite nice that Bagnaia is the guy dominating MotoGP in this era, because he always has this capacity for something like that to happen. It's quite useful for keeping title battles alive. Now, every top MotoGP rider, you know, I can remember Marquez crashing out of race leads, I can remember Valentino Rossi, Jorge Lorenzo, maybe not Lorenzo so much, but most of them, you know, MotoGP is so raw and difficult. It's not people... Amazing riders crash out of leads and make mistakes, but Bagnaia does have that slight susceptibility where he's, when he's leading by miles, a bit of you still thinking, is he actually going to shunt this at some point while under no pressure? He can't be complacent. He's capable of letting this slip, even though he's so calculating. Yeah, he does throw things away.
He can't be complacent because Jorge Martin arguably should have beat him last year, and if he's forgotten that, he will remember that today. He would look at the points table, he'd be like, all right, last year was kind of trouble and this guy's good again. He has to think about it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Until Bagnaia and Marquez bumped into each other, we were expecting to spend most of this podcast talking about Pedro Acosta again, because he was absolutely sensational in his second MotoGP weekend. So as he surged through the field, making other people on KTMs look, well, look like not the future, we were all thinking, like, yeah, is this going to be the same as Qatar? Are the tyres going to be wrecked and he'll slip backwards? And how far will he slip? And then, no, he doesn't slip backwards. He's there on the podium. Okay, he's helped by a few crazy events, which we'll get to later, but the second weekend in MotoGP on a Tech 3 Gas, not even proper KTM, he's on the podium. Who wants to go first on this one, Val?
I do think it's a proper KTM. I do think it's,
well,
I
mean, he was okay, even in the context of what Tech 3 Gas bikes have done in recent years.
Yeah, but
I know he is like to have a prettier version than, say, Remy Gardner.
I don't think that was a Tech 3 thing. Let me put it that way. I do not think that was a Tech 3 thing. But in any case, I mean, they did have him try the rear aero pretty early this weekend. So clearly they are incorporating him already, because they've seen what we've all seen. And what we've all seen is that he's massively ahead of schedule and scary good. And that weekend will visit Brad Binder and Jack Miller in their nightmares. Both post-race, sometimes riders don't like to praise their teammates very much when they've been beaten, but sometimes you're beaten so noticeably that you just have to go, fair enough, and, you know, grit your teeth and go, yeah, this is happening. And I think both of them sort of took that sort of attitude towards it. He kicked their butts. He did not great things to them. And it didn't really look like that from the start of the weekend. Remember, they made it to Q2 straight. He didn't. He was okay in the sprint, but none of them were particularly inspiring in the sprint. And then in the Grand Prix, Acosta just found an extra gear from one day to another, which is not too surprising for a rookie, but it says a lot about where the ceiling is, where the margin is. Obviously, in Binder's case, I don't think he likes Portimao very much on a MotoGP bike. And I think the baseline, like, he won't expect this to be particularly representative. But then again, Acosta has a lot more room to grow. And it did help that the tires weren't being chewed up, clearly. I think that also partly explains the comfort of Martin's win. And that also partly explains why in Moto2 we saw Fermín Aldeguer push every lap and not eat up the new Pirellis like he had done in Qatar. So I think this doesn't yet mean that, you know, this is going to be every race. But the timeline for me has changed now. There is no scenario now in my head in which KTM does not go into 2025 thinking Pedro Acosta should be winning us the title. Which it's maybe it's an overreaction in the emotion of the moment, but it's not even like, I know people are excited about how much he dances on the bike and stuff like that, and the overtakes he pulls and all the shows and like how he's all over the place and all the lines he's taking. I'm boring. I don't care about any of that. I look at the red sectors on the lifetiming and I go, woo! And I did that a lot this weekend. And especially on Sunday, he's good. He's so good. And just one final thing. I know this is way too long a rant. I apologize for this. I now have the suspicion, and I think he also has the suspicion, that the Moto2 version of Pedro Acosta is the worst version of Pedro Acosta. Ooh. That's the category he did not click with. He won the world championship in that category. And I think it is pretty obvious that Moto3 and MotoGP suit him better. So good luck with that, everybody else.
We had a conversation recently on here about my belief that KTM should switch him and Jack Miller and put him into the factory colors so that he can have a proper crack at 2025. I'm starting to think, like, this weekend has confirmed that I am 100% correct in my own eyes in that regard, because this kid could be a title contender next year. That is the level of what we saw at the weekend. And it's not just what we saw at the weekend. It's what we saw this weekend compared to the previous MotoGP weekend. Because he did the same thing in both weekends, except he learned all the lessons from round one and applied them to round two. And he had tires left at the end of the race and didn't burn them out. He is a super fast learner.
This is the amazing thing, isn't it? It's like there were asterisks and that he just blitzed away this weekend. It was, can he do this at a track where he hasn't had testing? Oh, yeah. Yes, he absolutely can. Did he come through Q1 as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's got to the podium from having had a, you know, not being absolutely on it through a slightly strange Friday. So not a problem. He's still on the podium at the end of the weekend. And then, you know, obviously the tyre question mark. And that's a question mark until probably the last five laps of this race. And that's like, oh, no, he's actually fine. He's attacked Marquez and Bagnaia. He's embarrassed Binder and Miller. And it's not a tyre wrecking mirage. It's absolute real pace.
If anything, he did a better job of conserving his tyres into the last few laps than Bagnaia and Marc Marquez, than the world champion and the six-time champion. I mean, he is just incredible. It's like,
yes,
it's like watching an AI ride a motorbike where they've like learned their mistakes, analyzed their competitors, and then done it better the second time. It's unreal what he did this weekend.
I know AI is in its relatively early stages compared to in 50 years' time when it rules us all or whatever, but I don't think AI is programming in those slides, those kind of crazy twitches when he's just thrown it down the inside of someone and run a mile wide and somehow ends up still coming out the corner in front.
Any other rider that did what he did into turn one against Bagnaia and got it so wrong and still managed to come out of it right on his tail, like anyone else should have crashed there. That was a Marquez level, like super high speed, oh yeah, no, it's okay, I've got this moment. He just powered through it and was just there in the exit again.
Is it more impressive than Marquez's first season? I'm starting to wonder if in performance terms
it is. There's no comparison.
What is going on? What is happening here?
I'm trying to reverse my head into 2013, and I just feel, I had this nagging feeling in Marquez's first season. Yeah, it was incredible.
No, yeah, I know what you mean, but
you know, Lorenzo, Pedrosa were injured at different times.
Yes.
There were big asterisks. And then we're not expecting Acosta to win the title, but in terms of sheer, like, whoa, performance, this does feel like something else. And listeners, if there are Acosta skeptics listening, and we're boring you, or you're doubting us as we go on rant after rant about this kid, email podcast@the-race.com and tell us your logic for being an Acosta skeptic, because I can't see any drawbacks with what this kid is doing at the moment.
I can conclusively make the argument that this is better than what Marc Marquez did in his first season, and I can do it using math.
Ooh.
Right? I've just pulled up...
I've got to see this.
I've just pulled up the championship standings from 2013. And there was... So, how many rounds in that season? It was an 18-round world championship. So, out of those 18 rounds... Tech 3 Yamaha scored 1, 2, 3, 4 podiums, and LCR Honda scored 1 podium. Every other podium that year was taken by a Repsol Honda or a Factory Monster, a Movistar Yamaha, as it was at the time. That's unheard of. Like, that just doesn't happen anymore. There was 4 bikes in that grid that could win a race. Right now, there's 8 Ducatis that could win a race, and then there's some other bikes that aren't as good at them as them, and Pedro Acosta's beaten most of them on one of the bikes that isn't as good. That, for me, is what makes this better than Marc Marquez's. It's the fact that he's at a huge machinery disadvantage to what Marc had. You know, Marc graduated to MotoGP in the best bike in the world, and as good as KTM is, Pedro Acosta did not do that. He graduated on... arguably the third, maybe the fourth best bike in this championship. But it's
Val's face as you said that. Val's just like, it's like Val just broke his neck.
I'm counting 4 GP24s and then 4 GP23s.
Okay. As different
and then
bikes. Yeah.
Maybe a KTM, maybe an Aprilia. It's a bit neck and neck between them. But he's in like, he is, and he's not in a factory bike. I don't care if Val says it's basically a factory bike, because satellite bikes don't win world championships.
I've heard this, Simon. The satellite bikes not win championships.
Who's leading the championship right now?
If he's on a satellite KTM and you presume that the KTM is the second best manufacturer in the grid, he's in the 11th best bike in the championship. And Marc Marquez was in the first best. So there it is. Via maths, he is undoubtedly far better than Marc Marquez was in his opening season.
far better. Well, okay. I'm not gonna get that.
And Marc Marquez took 2 seasons to win a title in the junior class. Not 1.
Oh, that was a little bit. That was that's a little bit affected by injury, isn't it?
No, that was Moto 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he means 1-5. He means 1-5. Yeah.
I mean 1-5.
Ah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I think he did 3 seasons in 1-5. Two and a half.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But this is both more and less Larry than I expected. I don't really know how to process it, but I would say I think there's a bit of Marquez tax going on where you just look at him with a Cota right away and go, well, he just does that. Doesn't matter. I don't think you can apply that to a rookie Marquez. I don't think that's entirely fair. I do see the point you're making about it being different MotoGP eras and having a safety cushion of like you can have a weekend where you're just a bit crap, relatively speaking, and still finish fourth very comfortably. That's no longer a luxury. And that's, I mean, that probably actually does more than anything convey how good modern MotoGP is in terms of the talent at the top, which I think a lot of people don't fully recognize still.
The only thing, this is not a skeptical Acosta point, but it's kind of where does this go next point. So during the race, one of the things I said to you guys in our work chat was, I said, I feel like Acosta's got like a free half season here where he can just do what he likes, make the moves he wants, just go for it, because there's nothing at stake. No one's expecting him to be world champion or win races. Well, we may be expecting to win a race in 2024, but there's no pressure expectation. It's just go out there, impress, be aggressive, lay down some markers. Now we're 2 weekends in and they've both been this good. If he when he has his first crash, because it'll happen, when he has his first stumble or weekend where he just doesn't figure things out, does that start getting more costly? If next season he isn't in title contention, do we start talking about him? Is he raising the bar a bit too high, or is he just that good that actually this is just gonna keep going and going, just be hilariously entertaining and impressive all season?
I think that's a risk. I think that's a real risk in terms of maybe, I don't know, he does seem mentally bulletproof, but it is sort of a, because I think we do, like when a rider debuts so well, we do sort of penalize them for not maintaining that same rate of progress. And I think the biggest example of that is Jorge Martin, who's leading the championship right now. Jorge Martin has repeatedly pointed to the fact that there are similarities between how he began his MotoGP career and how Pedro Acosta began his MotoGP career. He is completely right. He is like 100% right. There's just, for me, there's really no disputing that Martin was kind of doing a similar sort of thing at the start of his career with a better bike. I know, with a better bike. I know, Simon, I know, better bike. Still, I don't think it was like light years away. And then, unfortunately, he got hurt at Portimao and we didn't really see how that natural progression goes from there. But I don't think this is unprecedented so much. But I do think like it's making this crazy impression that at a certain point there will be a plateau and we have to see what happens after that plateau. But also, yeah, Simon says that KTM might want him to fight for the title in 2024. I don't see how you don't expect that immediately right away. Like
25,
yeah. Sorry, so did I say 24? Yeah. You have to prepare for that mentally already. He has to be fighting for the title in 2025. For me, that's the situation we're in already.
Should we talk about some people who won races this weekend? We're quite away into this podcast. We probably should. Before we get, I feel like I'm pushing.
Oh God,
he might crop up in this bit. I feel like I'm pushing Martin to the back of the podcast, but there's good reasons for that this time. Maverick Viñales showed race pace, made a win happen, helped by Bagnaia making a mess of the sprint, but Maverick Viñales is a race winner again on an Aprilia. And let's do the glory for Viñales first. Very impressive performance on Saturday, very, very impressive. My only thing with it is, where has it been? Where is it going to happen again at different tracks? Like, Maverick, come on, we know you're capable of this. Please do it more often.
I think that he was about to do it on Sunday again.
Yeah.
And that gives me some confidence in him for the first time since like the fourth race of the 2017 season.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you on that.
Val's face. I know, Val. But like he's been the most disappointing rider in modern MotoGP history.
Val's face has gone again at that, but I can see your logic.
I know what he means.
I know. He dominated Yamaha testing. You know, that first season, he like smashed lap records at every circuit we went to. He won 3 of his first 5 races in the Yamaha. And then just the rest of his career has been meh intermingled with the odd moments of "What the hell are you doing, man?" whenever he decides to blow up a bike mid-race, or, you know.
I mean, great storyline, thank you, but...
Oh, yeah, glorious. But it's just, it's permanently up and down.
Yes, yeah.
And it's so hard to get excited about the ups, because the ups have never been that high. They've never been, like, super high.
And when they are, they're not consistent.
But even when they are high, it's like a pole position or a podium.
Yeah, in the Aprilia days.
It's not a race win. And at the end of the day, we're all here to win races. Like, that's what it's all about. So until he started winning races again, it's been really hard to get excited about him. He rode an excellent race on Saturday. And actually, he rode a better race on Sunday. And unfortunately, the result essentially got taken out of his hands, and he didn't see the checkered flag. Because of, you know, naming a more iconic duo than Aprilia and reliability problems. The bike decided to first to break on him and then to try to kill him. And it's frustrating. But honestly, his body language after the race was super positive. Like, he ended the day cheery because I think he has to end the day cheery, because he believes he's got his level back. He showed not once but twice that he has got his level back. And even if the result wasn't there at the end, he has to, you know, keep his own level high, maintain his own mental well-being going into the next race so that he can try and do something spectacular again.
So before Val comes in, I just want... So Val, you're particularly good at great descriptions of incidents and bringing them to life. I'm going to try this one with how Vinales exited the Grand Prix, because it just reminded me of my two-year-old son entering a room and trying to do some dancing and then falling over. Basically, so he comes out the final corner, the bike seems to slow, he sort of judges a bit, waggles a leg in the air, runs massively wide at the first corner, and then just sort of does a little somersault, almost on the spot somehow, on some mud, and then just sort of Maverick Vinales sits down and looks confused. So for the benefit of listeners who didn't see any of the news or hear the explanations after the race, what actually happened to his bike to cause that odd toddler dancing scenario?
So the explanation from Aprilia so far is suspected gearbox issue, which has been corroborated by a bunch of riders riding around Vinales. And when I say a bunch of riders, I mean Enea Bastianini. I don't know why I said a bunch of riders. It's been corroborated by Bastianini and Vinales himself. And Aleix Espargaró reckoned it might be like the same root cause as what popped his chain off last year at Jerez, I believe.
Yeah.
So that makes it even more galling, because like Vinales was just let down. They let him down this weekend after everything he went through. And I want to let's talk about about the issue some more, because it didn't just rob him of a finish. I think it robbed him of a win. I think the argument put forward by him for why it robbed him of a win is persuasive. It wasn't just, it didn't come out of nowhere. The whole race, he says he was struggling from with the upshift from the fifth gear to sixth gear. And it was obviously on the main straight is where you felt it. And if you watch the lifetiming of the race, you could see him absolutely monstering Jorge Martin through the final sectors, through those, you know, downhill right-handers, super quick. And then all the momentum is gone through the first sector. And every time you're like, just what happened? Where did the time go? Is it just the Ducati grunt? Despite the exit out of the final corner, which is normally, because it's quick enough to where it normally doesn't make the difference on acceleration. But when he explained it, it was like, oh, that makes total sense. It makes total sense why you could not get close to Jorge Martin. He would have been close. Whether he would have overtaken him or not, I think is a different case. But he had a ton of pace all weekend, despite having a stomach bug throughout. He described as gastroenteritis, which made me finally learn on Google what gastroenteritis actually means and how it's different to gastritis. I don't know. I'm still not sure I know.
Tell us after the podcast, because it probably doesn't make great listening.
No, I'll just do it now. No, the problem is, I don't believe anything's changed. I don't buy it. But also, I'm in a position where like I struggle to care, and I feel really sad because he got let down in his perfect weekend. He did such a good job. He demolished all the other Aprilias. He was on cloud nine despite his health issues. I'm sort of in a position where I'm, I don't know, to borrow a line from a movie title, how I learned to stop worrying and love the peaks. This is one of those Maverick Vinales peaks where he he shows the level of talent, and the level of talent is mesmerizing, and it's incredible. I don't buy for a second this level's going to be sustained, even maybe at Kota, because he liked Kota, but not meaningfully across a range of circuits. I kind of don't care. He should have won. I feel really sad that he didn't win. Maybe it was a sort of a compensation for the sprint win that he shouldn't have had that Bagnaia gave him. Just count it as a Grand Prix win anyway, that sprint win. I don't know.
Well, this is it. Is Vinales now officially the first person to win on three manufacturers in this era? Has he won?
Has he won in
MotoGP on an Aprilia? Simon
yes.
is passionately nodding.
Yes. Yes, he has.
Val is passionately putting his thumb up.
100%.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? So here's my only objection. So literally, he has won a MotoGP race. Mm-hmm. Some MotoGP bikes were on the grid racing, scoring points. Yes, he has won a MotoGP race on the Aprilia. That is absolute fact. He hasn't won the MotoGP Grand Prix. I don't care. Some Grand Prix have been different lengths at different times. He's led to beat those 21 other riders. He did it. The only time I get sympathy with the sprint don't count stats argument, and maybe this gets knocked down straight away because calendars are longer now as well, but in eras where it's the era comparison, until last year, people didn't have double the chances to win a race every season because they didn't have sprints as well. They didn't have a chance to score a race win by only sustaining that performance for half distance. I do think he's won a race. I also think it counts for slightly less than if he'd done it in a Grand Prix.
For me, there's so many factors that come into account whenever it comes to comparing eras that it makes it basically irrelevant, and a sprint should be just a race win. You could also say that, you know, we could go back 10 years and say, well, he didn't have a factory Honda or a Yamaha, so obviously he wasn't able to win a race, so those races are worth less. Or you could go back to 1949 and say there was only six rounds that year, so that's a different era. Or you could go back to 1974 and say we're still racing at the Isle of Man, and obviously a senior TT that's six laps of the 40-mile course is more difficult than running around Montjuic in Barcelona on a short circuit. There's so many things have changed over the eras that I don't think that we should be denying him his rightful place in history because of the way things were, essentially.
I agree with Simon 100%. I think the changes in calendar and sport have basically sent all of those direct numerical comparisons between eras straight into the toilet and flushed down repeatedly. It is worth less, and the points reflect that. And that's fine. Yes, it is a lesser distance. It is, it is a different thing, and more laps arguably means more difficult. I think you could actually make the argument that maybe not, because it's such a different discipline at that point, winning over 10 laps instead of winning over 20. It doesn't feel like a lesser effort. It genuinely feels like a different skill is being measured. And that's for me, that's the part for me where I have no issues if they decide to count these as wins. Because it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. Those always look like races. They are not short enough not to be races. This is not a Formula One situation where you just extricate the first stint of a Grand Prix. They are genuinely close enough and different enough, but not meaningfully easier for me. But I think the thing that really completely fully swung me, and I'm lying, I was swung before, but today in particular, we watched the World Superbikes race, the Super Pole race, they Super call pole it. Race. I just call it a sprint because that makes more sense to me.
The second race of the weekend.
The second race of the weekend, Saturday the morning race. And World Superbikes initially wasn't going to count these races as wins and then changed their mind. And today showed to me that they were completely correct. It was absolutely bananas. It was one of the nuttiest things I've ever seen. If you can track down that race, do it 100%. It is going to be the best piece of weekend action you're going to find from this weekend.
The last laps on my Twitter timeline.
Yeah. Yeah, last lap enough is good, but all the whole thing was deranged. It was mental. I can't say enough about it. It was so crazy. But it was so difficult, clearly, for everybody. And the way it was decided and the way everybody was racing, the amount of risk everybody was taking, it was a full race for a full win. That feels intuitively obvious to me. And then they had the fuller distance race later on, and you could tell that everybody was pacing themselves differently and the gaps were more stretched out, and the winner won by 2 seconds with 7 seconds to third place. It's different things. It's just, it's different skill sets. I do not meaningfully think that that race was obviously objectively harder than the sprint. I'm fine with it paying a lot more points, but a win's a win for me.
Should say that Maverick Vinales is of the impression that his Saturday was a lot harder than Sunday. Because I asked him about this, and like he and other riders are adamant that they race harder on sprints because you don't have to think about tire life. You don't have to. You can push harder. You can be more aggressive. You can take more risks. And we've seen that. We've seen the sprint injury rate. You know, sprints are probably more dangerous per lap completed than Sunday races because they're insane.
Okay, I'm going to relent. We're, I don't know, 50-odd minutes into the podcast. Let's talk about championship leader and Grand Prix winner Jorge Martin, who...
I like that you said 48 and we're 51 in. That's well
yeah,
done,
I
Matt.
Thought it was being hyperbolic, well but actually we got it.
Well
it's crazy.
Done.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, well done.
We had a habit last year around the autumn of getting to the winner 47 minutes into a podcast that became our kind of regular average, I think, at one point. So that was during rider market time when we were just spending 47 minutes banging on about Marc Marquez potentially joining Ducati before getting to the actual race. But yeah, Jorge Martin is championship leader by 18 points after 4 races over Brad Binder. And this was not a Jorge Martin style weekend. In the, you know, when Jorge Martin was breaking away briefly at the start of the Grand Prix, I think, Simon, was it you who said in our work chat that he's like putting pace over his like sensible chances of winning, like he's burning his tires up? If he then made up for it very well. He controlled the thing.
Please don't clip this. I think he might win the championship. Please don't include this anywhere. Edit it out.
No. Johnny, producer, this stays in. Val is that. But Val, have you not heard that he's a satellite rider? And I've heard that riders don't win championships.
Actually, yeah. So he might as well park up at Kota.
It's round two.
There's weird things going on with Jorge Martin. The weirdest thing for me this weekend was he wasn't very good over one lap, it felt like, or at least not very good by his standards. He just didn't find the one lap pace. He wasn't very good in the sprint. He had the rear chatter that continues to blight him on when it's a softer rear. He just gets the rear vibration into the corners and he starts to struggle. And then he was very, very strong on Sunday throughout the race distance with basically no mistakes. Nea Bastianini described him as perfect on Sunday, and that's basically that is what it looked like with a more functional Aprilia RSGP. Maybe that would have been only good enough for second, but still, I was thoroughly impressed. Yeah, we need to see it on the tire wear tracks. We need to see it in some other places. I don't want to say we need to see more. We need to see more to like crown him championship favorite or something. But as far as like title contender on level ground with the others, for me, he's 100% there. Because every time I look at live timing in any MotoGP session and Jorge Martin starts a lap, I know it's going to be a fast one. And that's more than anything. We talk about analysis. We talk about, you know, looking at the patterns of the data, whatever. I'm a fraud because whenever I look at any of this stuff, that's what my ape brain goes to first. Do I expect this guy to do a fast lap? And with Jorge Martin, increasingly, every single time, the answer is yes, 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 yes. Which is why I'm starting to believe.
I mean, Val, you've kind of lambasted yourself there for being someone who talks and writes about motorsport, who looks to see if people go fast on bikes as kind of a measure of success. I think that is absolutely fine as a measure of success in your role. But you know, we're used to seeing the extremely fast laps. We're used to seeing the poles and the sprint wins. There was a measured control to this. It was like Bagnaia's Qatar Grand Prix victory. It was like, right, get the job done on the first lap and then control the pace from there. Go fast when I need to. Don't go fast when I don't need to. And he kept something in his pocket. Okay, you're right. Vinales was having having problems to deal with. But even once the start had been nailed, winning the race would still require Maverick Vinales on an Aprilia to overtake Jorge Martin on a Ducati, and I don't see that happening. And you know, Martin had this sorted.
The bit for me that was kind of the most telling about his weekend was in the press conference afterwards, I started to ask a question about to Martin about, you know, you looked like you were controlling the race. You looked like, as it turned out, you were saving your tires really well. Everything was in control. You looked super mature. And before I had a chance to finish the question, he was shouting like, yeah, I was mature. Like, he knew what was coming. It kind of answered the question before I'd finished saying it, because I think he saw that in himself as well. That this was, you know, we kind of agreed in the answer that it was the most mature race win of his career, because it was sensible and not stupid. And I think if Maverick Viñales had caught him and had looked to be ready to do more than Martin was to win, Martin would have let him win and taken second. And that would have been his biggest statement. And he kind of implied that. He kind of said that he wasn't willing to crash to win the race because he was thinking about Indonesia last year. And you know, that's why he didn't try to win the race by 3 seconds, and why he was happy to settle to try and win it for less than a second, because he was managing the gap. It was a different Jorge Martin. It was the guy that, you know, if this guy had turned up after the summer break last year, he probably would have proven me wrong and won the championship, because he wouldn't have given away some of the big points that he did. I mean, if he proves me wrong this year, he proves me wrong, but he definitely looks like a different character.
There's that still trademark, and I want to say arrogance in a good way, to the way Jorge Martin speaks in public. Like arrogance can be annoying, but in this particular case, there's something very endearing about whenever he's asked about his Ducati future or whatever, anything like that, the undertone of his answers is always, what do I have to prove? I am so obviously the fastest guy here. I always hear it in basically every answer about his future. When he's asked, you know, what's the deadline on the Ducati 2025 decision of who they slot in to next to Bagnaia? The answer is, I have time and I will prove it to them, and I already have. And he's kind of right. You know, there is a lot of recognition, I think, among his MotoGP peers that in terms of the burst of pace that he's able to uncork right now, this guy cannot be matched. The question is whether there will be tracks where that alone does not bring you points. The question obviously is whether he's going to crash and give up points away for stupid reasons, but I think that is a question also for Pecco Bagnaia, as we've seen today. But it is that sort of Sunday strategery again versus just lightning. But this weekend, lightning was indeed controlled. I am always wary of taking a lot on board from that, because it's also a very particular track, Portimao. Like, the tires weren't wearing. Rookie Pedro Acosta, again, had his fastest lap on, 22 out of 25? So clearly, Martin's major weaknesses weren't fully tested. And he still has the rear chatter thing that's going on. But what he sees, I see. This whole, don't you all see I'm the fastest? I do kind of see it, man. That's the part that's really capturing my imagination right now. It's going to change entirely in a week. Why does anybody listen to me?
One other guy I want to get into this podcast is Ennea Bastianini, who is top works Ducati in the championship, third in the points, 21 points behind Martin. Pole sitter this weekend, very close second to Martin in the Grand Prix after what turned out to be quite a ropey sprint. There's enough evidence that Bastianini's back now, I think. This is working now. We're starting to see what Bastianini on a factory Ducati is going to do, and it's pretty good. And there's still this, you know, there's wobbly moments, but is he our fourth title contender? Can we go that far yet?
I don't know, because it looks a bit fragile, because I'm not actually sure we've seen like a race yet, or even really definitely a session where you look at Ennea Bastianini, you're like, you've got the best pace. You're the quickest guy here, which I think you need to have those days and those moments to be really in the championship mix. And I know I say that on the weekend where he took his second pole in MotoGP. So yeah, Ennea Bastianini is getting poles now. So in theory, everybody should be scared. Yeah. But I think the race pace was just a bit not quite there this weekend. I don't really fully understand what's going on. But in terms of the points haul, he'll be happy with how the weekend went. In terms of picking up a pole position, I mean, Ennea Bastianini on pole, that's got to count for a lot. That's got to be quite important. And in terms of Ducati 2025, if I was Ducati, I have no idea what I'd be doing at this point. This is awful. Like, how do you decide anything? Like, they're all at the front all the time. What are you supposed to do with that? Which one of them do you let go and then cry about it when they make an impact somewhere else? Awful. What an awful situation. Poor Ducati, as we always say in these episodes.
They have to just pump a load of money into making Pramac look like the greatest place on earth for whichever person doesn't get the factory right. be it Martin or Bastianini, they need to like they should be like publishing their salary they should be sending it out in a press release, like, this is how many millions you will earn for being a satellite Pramac rider because you're more important than all the other MotoGP riders. That's the level of PR offensive they should be running here to try and convince these guys to stay, because they can't run an extra factory bike. They can't do a 2009 Repsol Honda. There is an element of ego in play with all of these guys. And my only kind of thought on that is that maybe Bastianini is the guy who could be enticed to stepping down to Pramac more easily on a really, 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 like they need to make them not the satellite team they are now, but like a super satellite team, even to the next level. Like Gigi needs to start wearing a Pramac shirt on weekends level of you know, that's where this needs to go. To try and convince them that they can keep all three of them, because how the hell otherwise do you pick which one of them to get rid of?
Yeah, it's tough. I think it goes beyond performance, very much beyond performance. It's just, what do you want from your factory team? To me, it's because there you can make a case for basically any of them. Even if Bastianini goes back to sort of slightly more subdued form, like in Qatar, you can still absolutely make the case that for continuity and for serenity and for not having a rider on the other side of the garage who will quite plausibly collide with Pecco Bagnaia in multiple weekends in a year. It's tough. It's a difficult one. And I think what they decide will show us a lot about how Ducati views its current position and how it operates and what it prioritizes. I can't wait. I'm desperate to know. Why won't they tell me? Why wouldn't... Just tell me. I won't tell anybody, I promise.
I just thought that we wouldn't get into the 2025 rider market in this episode when I looked at the plan. And
whoopsie.
Whoops. Ah, well. So, I think that will do for Portimao. MotoGP now has a few weeks off because Termas isn't happening, so we'll reconvene at Austin for COTA in the middle of April, where we're expecting a double Marc Marquez win at one of his specialist tracks. Before then, we've got a couple more interview episodes for you. Simon, do you want to reveal to listeners who we'll be hearing from during this gap?
I had a very productive weekend at Portimao and got to spend 30 minutes with Davide Brivio, the new Trackhouse team boss, but obviously a massive MotoGP veteran, the guy who took Suzuki to a championship with Joan Mir, the guy who stole Valentino Rossi from Honda to Yamaha, the guy who has been brought into Trackhouse to turn them into, well, basically that super satellite team that we talked about what Pramac needs to be, as well as a brief stint in F1. We talked about all sorts of things. I think Val's listened to the interview with him and quite liked it, didn't bore him, so that's quite good. And then
I thought it was completely
excellent. Well, that really sells it, so enjoy that episode, folks. And then
it was good. A disclaimer, public service announcement, I am joking. Do not take anything I say seriously. Again, do not listen to me. This is,
and then we've been planning for a while to try and catch up with MotoGP sporting director Carlos Espeleta, and I bumped into him on Thursday and said, hey, you know, whenever you've got a free or a quiet weekend with a free half hour at some point, let's do it. And he was like, come to my office on Saturday morning, we'll do it then. We did a 30-minute podcast talking about the future of MotoGP from basically every direction imaginable, and then spent another hour sitting in his office watching qualifying, which was just as informative, but unfortunately off the record. So I learned lots, and you know, it'll help me and educate myself and yourselves going forward. But the interview is really good. He was super honest, open, didn't skirt away from any of my questions, even the kind of slightly complicated ones. And it'll be another good listen.
Unlike Val, I haven't listened to either recording yet, so I can only go into this with optimism and excitement, but no, that sounds absolutely mega. So, listeners, keep an ear out for those episodes between now and Austin. If you haven't already, please follow our new MotoGP-led social media channels at The Race Moto on X/Twitter and Instagram. Thank you for your company. We hope you enjoyed that race as much as we did. We hope you share our faith in Pedro Acosta, because this episode might have dragged a little bit for you if you just thought we were being three lunatics getting excited about an overrated teenager. We will be back in your ears with Davide Brivio next week.
The Athletic.